Welcome to the Building with Metal podcast, presented by McElroy Metal. Whether you're a contractor, architect, designer, or building owner, we're here to help you build better with metal roofing and siding products.
Building codes change constantly, and keeping up can feel like a full-time job. But missing a key update? That can mean financial troubles, missed inspections, and costly rework. In today's episode, we're cutting through the noise to try to help you understand the constant code changes, what you're facing right now, and what things you need to know before you go to your next job site or project. Hi, I'm your host, Kathy Miller, and today we're thrilled to be joined by Bob Zabchuk with ZTech Consulting. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Before we get started, in case some of our listeners aren't familiar with either yourself or ZTech, why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself and the firm?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm a third-party consultant that I serve mostly manufacturers and in the metal construction products industry space. I'm an engineer by training, graduated from the University of Texas at Austin in 1989, and spent 3 years with a consultant here in Houston, Texas, where I'm based, then moved into the metal building industry, actually, with a major manufacturer. I was there from 95 to 2018. So I did a lot of roles there, started out as design and a pricing engineer, moved up into engineering management, then actually was in charge of software development and standards development, and really kind of worked my way into a company was in acquisition mode at the time. So I worked my way into a product, really an R&D, a true R&D. So they recognized that in 2008, and I was promoted to director of research and development and position I held for about 10 years before I finally just decided to ditch corporate America and try to do my own thing. Yeah, well, I spent about almost 2 years in a solar industry business. Worked for a company and the manufacturer also in the San Jose, in the BIPV space. And while I thoroughly enjoyed that, and they're still a client of mine, my goal had always been to start my own engineering firm and do consulting work at some point. And so just felt like that opportunity was right. So in 2020, I launched my company and immediately started working with the Metal Construction Association, where I'm their technical director. But I also work with some private consultants individual manufacturers in the same space. It's a really great industry. What's really cool about it's the same people I work with. You know, a great example would be Ken, right, of your company. And so known him forever. And it's just been a great opportunity for me. And I've really not ever been happier in my job my entire life. It's been awesome.
Well, that is fabulous. Good for you. And way to take the plunge right into entrepreneurship and everything that goes with that. So, yeah. And always in the building construction products.
It's a little gutsy doing it in the face of a pandemic. We have mutual friends, Rob Attic, this guy, entrepreneurial businesses, he said, are opened in times of adversity. He says, no, actually, I would say your timing's perfect. And he turned out to be right.
Yep. No, that's very true, right? Because sometimes people feel like they've got nothing to lose, right? And so they're going to take a chance at it. So good for you. All right. So tell us a little bit about your role at MCA. You kind of made a little bit of a reference to that. But in case our listeners aren't familiar with the association and as technical director, what you do for the members, that would be great.
Great. Yeah. So, we work really closely. First off, Metal Construction Association, for those who don't know, is a trade association, and it's in the space of metal roof and wall cladding. And by metal, it's predominantly a steel market, but there's a lot of aluminum involved in what we call natural metals, copper, zinc, lead and things of that nature. So it's a very, diverse industry from product standpoint, but roof and wall manufacturers, and which is where I had a lot of my experience, right? It was mostly coming from steel, but I had some familiarity with aluminum design. And so when I, launched my consulting business, it was a good fit. And so I basically, MCA has a lot of projects going on. We've been working for a couple of different initiatives, getting, improvements in the building codes related to metal at roof and walls. And we also have done some sustainability research. We partnered with Oak Ridge National Labs on a project recently, plus this creation of education that we do through architects and other manufacturers as well, the contractors. And so I have a hand in all that. And it's been, again, really great chance for me to kind of diversify my skill set. And hopefully MCA is pleased. They've kept me around for about 6 years. So
I was going to say, yeah, I'm not sure how you get much done outside of the MCA's scope from my experience. Yeah, so, right. All right. Well, let's go ahead and dig into codes. I know there's lots of stuff we want to unpack for our listeners today. So where should we start with IBC, Bob, or do you want to start somewhere different?
Probably the best place. So the you know, for people who aren't quite as familiar with the process, right? Codes and to a little bit lesser extent, and standards, and I'll explain the difference in a second, but they are really not useful documents until they're adopted by some jurisdiction by means of ordinance or state law or some type of legislative requirement. And at that point, they effectively become law. And so, you know, if you go back and you think, really not unlike Congress would adopt a law or write legislation, they have to do so with a certain amount of transparency. Right? You can't create a law and let everybody, you know, just force it on everybody without having seen it. Prepare for it. Codes are the same way. So really what's happened is that, you know, when I first started in the industry, there was like, I don't know, 6, 7, what they call model codes, which are the high level codes, kind of all encompassing codes, uniform building code, standard building code, SBC. There are some states that have their own codes. So there's a movement in the 2000s to consolidate these under, you know, one code. It was the International Building Code, or IBC. And actually, that's a whole suite of documents, right? There's a fire code, plumbing code, performance code. They all sit under the ICC, International Code Commissal envelope. And that's what's called a model code. So the model code is pulled together in a specific process so that with, you know, the appropriate amount of transparency and openness, so that consensuses can be developed. And then put in, obviously, into writing, and that's a really important part, published in these documents to make them available for adoption as a jurisdiction. And then that's a code. So a standard is a different document. A standard is a way, think of it as a piece of a code, is a way to handle certain situations, structural loading, fire protection of high-rise buildings, types of testing, you know, the testing standards and ASTM standards and all that stuff. So that's delegated by the model code into a standard. And the standards, because they have their own similar processes, they have to be developed in an open form as well for much the same reason, so that the jurisdiction, when it's adopted, can say, yeah, that was developed in an open forum with, you know, debate and all stakeholders at the table. So that's easily said. It's really not even easily said. It's much easier, wildly difficult to do. And so what the International Code Council has done is created this process through experience and what has worked. And they have a series of hearings that they go through. And it's kind of like one of these shows, you know, that reality game shows, you know, where they got a whole bunch of people and then, oh, you're gone. And then at the end, maybe one or two people left. That's kind of how this works. So you start out with proposals, and MCA has been active in this, particularly in the last couple of cycles of ICC, because we're working on edge metal standard, right? So that particular standard is tested to determine the strength of elements that hold roof panels together across planes. So the edge, hips, valleys, you know, perimeter edge metal. This we found working through, recounting some of their storm investigations, that while metal panels were great, we know that. It's like if they do have problems, they tend to be in those areas. So, you know, those are things we need to button up. And, you know, the shingle industry's done the same thing. I mean, all the industries have kind of been working to that effect. But at any rate, so I've been working with MCA to get some of these improvements made into the code. So I've been through this process pretty recently. But yeah, so it just kind of goes through a series of hearings. Each time it's kind of refined. You get feedback from the committee. But then the whole time, anybody who's opposed to it or wishes to speak against it, they get 2 minutes at the microphone. It's all conducted in in-person hearings. And, you know, ultimately the committee votes on it. They recommend an action to what they call the governmental body, which is the final hearings after the public comments sessions and everything. The actual code official members of ICC vote on it, and they have the final say-so. But the whole idea behind the process is that more or less it's a rubber stamp to what the committee work has done up to that point. And so, yeah, it's a long evolved process. It takes really it's a full 3 years between cycles of those 3 years, 2.5 solidly on the development side. The last 6 months are mostly cleaning up and doing publishing fixes and things like that.
Okay, so that's really interesting. And so I just want to recap and to make sure I understood you properly. So anyone can bring a code change request to the board. And they agree to hear any of them regardless, or are some of them gotten rid of before they even make it to the board?
Well, obviously, you know, there's a set of rules in terms of what's in order and what's not. The general approach is there's an online database called CDP Access that you go online, you register, it's free, and you put in your code change proposal. So staff and the committee has had a chance to look at it before you get up to the microphone. So, yes, I mean, obviously, it could always be ruled out of order and never even been heard. But generally speaking, that's pretty uncommon. So usually what happens is you go, you know, your proposal, you write your proposal, they put it in a big monograph, and they go through them one at a time. So they might hear, you know, as many as 1,000 code change proposals over a 2-week hearing session at the very beginning. Then towards the end, as that gets whittled down, they might be looking at a few hundred. And then
wow. Okay.
But actually there are some that complete the process even beforehand. So they go into the consent agenda. So they're voted on in one big block at the end. Those tend to be the less contentious clarification issues where not a lot of people get up to the microphone speaking about it. So, the process has been designed to kind of through that sieve, so to speak.
And so if I understood you properly as well, you have to be willing to go, I don't want to, does defend the right word or present your request to the board?
Proponents and opponents.
Okay. Yeah. And so somebody's going to have to be willing to have some money to travel, right, and to take time away from. And so does that by nature reduce the group of the types of people that are bringing about requests?
I wouldn't necessarily reduce it, but what it does is it creates a situation where, you know, like MCA, you got a group that speaks on behalf of an industry to represent their interests in order to concentrate that, you know, effort. So yes, although we're not talking about, you know, these are not super grand hotels on Hawaiian Islands.
I'm somehow not surprised by that.
Yeah.
We're in the wrong industry for that, Bob.
Yeah, exactly. And you're there for, you know, I don't know. So it depends on, you know, which, so the different codes in different blocks, and you might be there for the whole solid 2 weeks, or unfortunately in my case, I was able to get this down to about 4 days, a 4-day window, but you don't know exactly when they'll be heard. They move at whatever pace they move. So yeah, it's you got to be on point for a good several days to be able to address those things.
So interesting. So I want to circle back on one other thing you mentioned, you know, and that's the codes change every 3 years. Is that correct?
The model codes do, right?
Okay. So where are we at in that cycle now?
Well, there are loosely way it's organized is they have parts of the code that they're grouped together into two groups. We call them Group A and Group B. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but basically Group A, as far as MCAs, we're really working on fire protection. That's the big focus of Group A for us. There are other areas, and they'll do residential and commercial at the same time in the same group. So they're cut horizontally instead of vertically, if that makes sense. And then the second group is Group B, which is a structural code. So they'll do, in the first year, they'll go through Group A. In the second year, they'll go through Group B. And then the third year, they'll do public comments and pull all those together in the final first half of the third year. Yeah. And then, you know, then they get into publishing phase.
Okay. And so what code year are we in now? And, you know.
So we are working on what will be the 2027 International Building Code. So technically it's the new version of the 2024 code, but yeah, that's what it will be once it goes through its approval process.
Okay. And just out of curiosity, I mean, you've obviously been at this a long time and have a wealth of experience. Are we seeing more code request changes in recent years versus history, or kind of stay level?
It's definitely on the increase, particularly in the energy codes. And ICC's that's created a situation where ICC had to respond to that increased volume. And so they actually split. Originally, the International Energy Conservation Code, I think, was in Group B. But then 2 cycles ago, you know, that code in particular was getting more and more proposals than the other parts of the code, they actually split that up into its own process. So it works in parallel. Now that one is, they call it a continuous maintenance process, but it's really not. It's on essentially the same hearing schedule. It's just most of the all of the meetings actually are virtual. It's a different database you're entering in, you're working with. But the two processes have more in common than they do different. It's really on the execution side. They're quite different. But in terms of the gates that you pass through to get into ultimate approval, it's the same type of process.
Okay. And so earlier you made reference about the code, right? And then states either can choose to adopt all or part, right? And then use standards. And so kind of walk us through, if you would, that a little bit, Bob. You know, why are they allowed to do that? And what kind of implications does it have? How does the contractor know to make sure which state, you know, laws they're under, et cetera?
Great question. You could almost have a separate session on this. So I'll cover it as best I can. First off, the short answer is politics. And I don't mean that negatively. It's really more political identity. Each state has different identities and philosophies in terms of how they implement codes. So just talk about the two extremes, which this extreme, we'll call it A. I don't want to say right or left. But one extreme is the code is set at the state level. The municipalities get no say so in what happens, how it's enforced. Even enforcement's done to the state level. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is what they call home rule states, where the state's pretty much absent from the code adoption inspection process. They might fund or provide funding assistance for municipalities, but ultimately it's up to the municipality or the local jurisdiction, that could be county, whatever, to adopt those codes. And then there's a whole slew of states in the middle. So one example of those, that might be Texas, where if ever you get onto the database, there's databases out there, so which codes are applicable and which apply in which state. If I ever go out there and look at my home state, Texas, it would tell you IBC 2018 is the model code. But I can tell you from experience of living in Texas that that's really not the requirement. That's what the state has identified as the minimum requirement, but that can be met in other ways. Really, it's driven a lot, at least in Texas, by the insurance industry, because they wanted to see a bare standard in place, because we have coastal communities, right? Just like Florida has, subject to really intense wind loads. So they set this kind of bare minimum, but then the municipalities, that's what you got to have insurance, but the municipalities can adopt whatever they want. And so really, as a municipality is saying that, well, that's really the minimum, and it may not even apply to the coast. So they get to do something specific in their half. So it looks like Texas is a state-mandated code, when in reality, in practice, it's really anything but. It varies quite a bit by jurisdiction. Except along the coast.
Yeah.
And again, those are driven by insurance requirements. Those municipalities actually might have different codes, but the state has come along and said, in order for you to have insurance in this county, you must meet this code here. So in effect, that's a state mandate, but technically it's not. So they all work differently is really the answer to it. And they all have different timelines in terms of adoption. Some of them are just known for adopting the new codes right out of the bucket, and there's others that are very slow to adopt. Then you got Florida and California and some other states where it's a completely different code. It might be based on IBC or based on a previous state code, but it is its own animal, and they have their own processes and timelines as well. I mean, it's kind of the nature of this beast. You've got to monitor it on so many levels.
Right. And so how do they monitor? Let's say a builder is working. Does he go to the county when he applies for a building permit? Is that where he finds his code? Or
ultimately, the local, we call it AHJs, authority having jurisdictions, the official code term. So ultimately, wherever I am in the United States, there should be an AHJ. So an AHJ is the one who sets the requirements for the area where that project is located. Now, I know in rural parts of many states, the AHJ is just kind of somebody who answers a phone maybe at the state capitol and says, yeah, you're good to go with this permit. That alone varies, right? And versus like New York, which is the other extreme, where it's its own separate permitting office, its own separate building code, its own everything. And so, but the idea is that wherever you stand, the first place it goes, you AJH, AHJ, and then your AHJ should be able to direct you specifically to a code inversion, specific to the state, maybe. And many of them, I just straight out adopt the model code. And again, it just varies. But that's the place to start. As I mentioned, there are some pretty good databases out there, particularly on the energy code side with the Department of Energy, and they keep databases of which states or which codes are apply to which states, and they may even have links to specific amendments that state or jurisdiction has kept up. So that'd be on the energy side, great place to start, energycodes.gov. Same at website.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about maybe the process, right, and the structure. Is there mm-hmm. anything else we need to hit on that before I kind of want to move into impact and effects and stuff now?
No, I think you get the concept of it. I guess the one thing is, it's keep in mind it works differently, but, you know, with the same end goal of what congressional or even what happens at the state legislatures. It's a very open forum structured process that you really happens at a high level and then gets implemented granularly at, you know, down to the county level even.
Okay, that makes sense.
Just to recap,
exactly. Okay, so, you know, you've talked a lot that you've been working on some stuff, you know, with MCA, and you were able to get through some stuff. I know you said in 4 days. So talk to us specifically about metal roofing and wall systems, you know, anything that may catch contractors off guard if they're not paying attention to but do updates?
So, we as an industry, and we're not unique in this, so all industries work within, I mentioned delegated standards, ASTM test practices or other. We also work through those organizations. And so really probably the best way to illustrate this is what we're seeing happen along the coast, as you might imagine, with the increased storm-related losses in Florida, which just really crazy gone high this year, both in terms of more storms impacting it, but also being more expensive to replace or rebuild, right? So that cost is going up exponentially everywhere. And so the whole idea is that, you know, that as we try our best to make sure that the products that we're producing are insurable, that meet a certain performance level, but also are affordable. We work in that respect too. And so, you know, wind loads have been, the reason why I brought that up as an example is wind loads has really been a big, the increased wind loads in ASCE 7 and some of the more stringent testing requirements you see in some of the changes ASTM has driven a lot of this, right? And so why that affects the contractors as manufacturers, knowing that those are our test standards that we have to comply with, and we have to meet certain performance levels with those tests, and when a test change and we have to retest, that's great. We know how to build that sample specimen. We know how which lab to send it to. We can test it. We can get a rating on it. But that's only half the problem. We have to make sure that manifests itself in the field, right? That's really critical. So as manufacturers, the way we do that is we publish details, right? And your company does it. Other companies in the space do it. And the wealth of information that's in these details is phenomenal. And to think that that's freely available for the download kind of blows my mind sometimes. But the idea is that, you know, as a manufacturer, or excuse me, as the installer, you have to have that information. You have to have it at your hand, at the tip of your hands. And so when an architect or engineer is working with a specific project, a lot of times they download our the manufacturer's details and use them as a starting point, or they may just say, hey, go see this manufacturer's details in the specification. So it's a lot of information for a contractor to be caught up with at all times. And we have empathy for that. We understand that alone can be a roadblock. So we work really hard on education. But that would be the main thing, stay on top of those details, understand that when test changes in the test happen, that those changes have to manifest themselves as new details, different ways to put things together in a field. Keep your folks educated. And, you know, MCA, for instance, has worked with NRCA to produce a certified roof installer. MCA has certified roof products or systems on our website. And there's also just the whole idea of trying to you know, verify performance in the field, that happens in the state of Florida or with TDI. And so it's a lot of checks and balances in that system to make sure that everything gets installed as it was planned. And it's really important to stay on top of that. And you see a lot of manufacturers going with this preferred installers route as a way to mitigate that, which I think is a great idea. You can train installers to nuances specific to your product. They have special access to experts in the office who can talk to get unique problems in the field solved. And of course, knowing who the preferred installers are, we can work very hard to keep their information update and accurate to make sure that they're looking at the latest details and the latest installation manuals and things of that nature. That's really, really important. And it's part of this industry. Part of the reason why metal roofs perform so great, it's a huge reason why they perform so well in the field. And we have to maintain that. In fact, a lot of times when we do see problems in the field, it's because those details weren't followed through all the way. And it shows up in, Edgemel is a great example of that. So we worked with other agencies to get that problem solved. And I like the solution we've come up with.
Good. And so at this point, that's moving forward in the 2027 code at this point.
Yet to be seen.
Fingers crossed.
We'll see what happens. I don't want to jinx it.
Okay, that's fair enough.
But we work with other partners and industry associations as well to help them. They help us. I mean, it's a collaborative effort. And we try really hard to actually work with each other, even though we're competing materials. I know the folks at the Asphalt Roofing Manufacturers really well. I know the people at Single Pot Roofing Institute really well. They know me. We work together. We answer each other's questions. It's a very, behind the scenes, a very collaborative effort, and I'm very proud to be part of it, really.
I was going
to
say that actually, that's a very helpful thing, right, for all building donors and everybody in the construction market. So,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay, so you've mentioned energy codes a couple times. Obviously, that's probably one of the biggest, changes we're all facing, right, regardless of which political party is in office. And so let's talk about that a little bit. What do you see as the most important thermal or air barrier requirements that builders need to be aware of and maybe on the cusp of change? Well,
I think pretty much without a doubt, it would be the increased use of whole building testing to meet compliance. It has a lot of, it's an easy thing to say, it's a hard thing to achieve. If you go back to two cycles ago, maybe three cycles ago, 10 years, we were all focused on insulation levels and U factors and R values and all that modeling. And what we found is that we made those improvements and we're getting the results we hoped for in the field. But at the same time, we get to the point where cost effectiveness starts to be a challenge, right? 60-year payback on a building that may not be around that long. It doesn't make a lot of business sense. And so I'm talking about really in the code and standards world, ASHRAE and organizations like that started looking at what other ways. And so air barrier, and you've mentioned that air barrier testing is a huge part of that. And so the idea, of course, is that I have a building or at least part of a building and I pressurize it and I'm holding it at a steady pressure and I get an idea of how much air is escaping through whatever, holes around windows. And I repair them once I find them. And this has been used as a troubleshooting mechanism forever, right? It's just not new technology. But what's different about this now is that now, instead of getting the best number you can, now you're trying to hit a certain number spot on, and we don't have crystal balls, right? We don't know how a given building is going to perform. We don't know. And so now that we got a specific minimum we got to match, it's real important, again, details, right? So we've tested certain types of details. We know they work well. We need to use those details when they're appropriate, best of our ability, so that you don't get in a situation that I found myself in, my clients, that's quite a bit early on, which is, we failed this whole building test miserably, and the thing's done, dried in, getting testing. We didn't get the test lab out in time, so we got interior finishes. What do we do? And it's a lot easier to solve that problem, way before you get to that point. And that's really what it was all about. And what we found, particularly in my work with MBMA, but MCA also, is that by putting these details out there and doing research and showing people producing reports and showing how to do this stuff, we found that performance went up and up and up to the point where it's like those numbers, as they sit now, are easy to achieve. Just got to be careful, right? But we're actually really adding a whole lot of costs. It's just, you know, creating a situation where best practices are the norm and not the exception is really what it's all about.
So how do contractors get trained on the new, you know, there's codes, but what if it's a change to an mm-hmm. assembly method? How do they get that information, mm-hmm. Bob?
Well, that's push them to the manufacturer first. As manufacturers, we work to try to keep our clients, you know, well-educated and well-briefed on those subjects. Where it gets tricky is when some of these changes might cross disciplines, right? So if we're generally, training and educating metal roof wall panel installers, but if this is a mechanical penetration issue, is that the mechanical contractor? You have to really stay abreast of those kind of things. And so you hear a lot that people talk about integrated design. And the whole idea behind integrated design is that, you know, instead of waiting for the architect to finish the plans and then they get submitted for permit, and then when the permit, then it goes out the bid, submitted for bid, and then it goes to permit, and then, you know, and this waterfall thing is to try to flip that around to where I'm going through and I'm making multiple passes of first doing a schematic design. But I'm actually working with installers and contractors and manufacturers throughout that whole process so that if there are details I should be using as a designer, I get access to those details. I understand that before I've done the drawing set so they can actually work through that process smoother. And I think that's a really great way to do things. And then stick to that plan. We don't see always, what happens a lot of times is that, the price comes out a little bit higher than the owner's anticipating. Let's go back and you hear the term value engineer. There's good and bad connotations with that. We're not going to get into that subject today, but bottom line to it is that post-design changes that affect the design is where a lot of these problems can happen. We need to hold those to a minimum through whatever process, right?
That's a really good point. Sometimes there's unintended mm-hmm. consequences, right, where somebody thinks about one part of the value engineering, but maybe not an right. absolute, yeah, mm-hmm. something
and,
else.
And again, a whole nother subject, but, we could talk about Grenfell. We could talk about Galloping Gertie. We could talk about the Hyatt. I mean, those are extreme examples, right, the Kansas City Hyatt. But the yeah. stories go on and on. And almost all of them have in common that scenario. Oh, we got so far, it's just too expensive. Let's go back and change how we did it. And then it was not, it didn't go through the entire design process. And what came out of the back end wasn't what is expected or hoped for.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Unintended consequences often with a big, big price for sure.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And we hope it's just for energy performance, right? We don't want anybody losing their lives in this area. Yeah.
Absolutely. The table stakes are high without a doubt mm-hmm. for sure. So, earlier you talked about codes and standards, and there's a couple other terms that I want to make sure we're kind of, wrapping up our time, but I want to make sure that we address a couple other terms for our listeners. What's the difference between a prescriptive path and a performance path, Bob?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell you that the idea here, and actually I'm going to point you to the Canadian Code. To me, the National Building Code of Canada does a great job of this. But the idea is that, ultimately what we want a building to do is meet all the performance requirements, both for life safety, energy performance, longevity, durability, all those things, right? But I can't write a code proposal that says, hey, in 30 years, this building needs to remain watertight, right? You can't grant a permit on that, right? So the Canadian code says, okay, these are the intents of the code, are actually different volumes. These are the intents of the code, and this is the performance we're expecting out of this building during its life. That's one division. Another division is these are the prescribed solutions that we have deemed through experience and history to meet those requirements. And that's where the word prescriptive comes from. So the idea is that a performance requirement is high level, long-term performance requirement that accomplishes directly accomplishes the goal of building performance. The prescriptive is a checkbox type of approach that just is shown through experience to get you to the ultimate performance. And we have tended to adopt and develop prescriptive codes in the United States and other places too, because, well, it just makes sense. It was hard. Again, don't have crystal balls. We didn't have supercomputers to model seismic events and wind events on to get up to research and how the building's responding and publish all those things. So prescriptive is really the only choice. What's going to be interesting to see is that as time goes on and we do have the capability to model those things virtually and to show that a building can survive a Loma Prieta and a Northridge, and even those two events magnified times 2.5 for appropriate factor of safety, this design shows through our virtual analysis or our analysis that virtually it would survive those events, then that would be really even better way or higher confidence way to produce that. So we're going to see those technology shifts over time. I may be long gone by the time they really, take in full effect, but I'm sure my children and grandchildren will be looking at buildings that have been designed on a computer and virtually tested to survive, shown to survive wind and rain events. And the prescriptive aspects of it would still be there, but you're going to see them play a smaller and smaller part for actually obtaining a permit. So hopefully that explained it well. But the short answer is, the prescriptive is the checkbox kind of way. I know through history and through experience that gets me to the performance, but ultimately performance is what we're after.
Right, for sure. Mm-hmm. Almost like a test lab versus real world, correct?
Yeah, so I know we're running out of time, but some of the cooler things I've seen, and I just can't let this go by without saying, but the Steel Framing Industry Association and some of our partners in the cold form steel just recently tested a 10-story building on the University of California's San Diego shake table. This is a 3D shake table, although we only use 2D, but it did north, south, east, west accelerations on a 10-story cold form frame building. Well over 100 feet tall, and it was sheathed in. And then when they were done, they wanted to see how it reacted to fire, so they set it on fire. And it's an amazing video to watch. You go download. I recommend your listeners here go download it. But not only is it really cool to see, it gave us a tremendous amount of information about the performance of those systems under those extreme environments. And these were all details and things that we know work. We used them before, but actually to see them perform like they were intended to perform in this building that was on the shake table under full instrumentation, mind blowing. And then to be able to say, to take that and say, okay, we're going to do a static load that is real time connected to those results in another lab to test other aspects of the building or new different solutions. Like that's where I'm going to see, that's when really exciting things are going to happen. We're going to see amazing leaps forward in technology here. Even though the actual technology we use to build the buildings may not change that much, all the design and things that we've done to get to that point are going to be radically different, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I had no idea a shake table existed, but I assume that the intent is to test for earthquake. Yeah. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And based off real-time data. So they could go, they have an accelerometer record for Loma Prieta, the 1989 World Series, of course, more commonly known. And they can recreate that ground motion on that shake table. They can even change it, modify it, and amplify it. Hmm. And they can line up four or five different earthquakes in a row and test these different because every earthquake's different.
Right.
So it's really fun and exciting stuff. And I'm even though I haven't played so much a direct role in that kind of project, it was fun to be sitting on the sidelines and watch it happen through an industry partner.
That is fascinating. I mean, awesome. I guess I have to ask, AI is touching everything. Mm-hmm. Technology, obviously, you just spoke about. Is there an AI piece that affects code?
No doubt. It'll show up exactly. Yeah, no doubt. It'll show up exactly as in that same way. It will be more oriented towards the solution to the ultimate problem of getting the building put together in the field in the right amount of time with the right amount of quality checks and things like that. Even the actual technology to assemble the building won't change. Everything up to then is going to be different. And AI is going to have a large part in that, no doubt. You're already seeing BIM programs that can design a building from a prompt. I've experimented and played with them. They got a long way to go at this stage. I'm not going to tell you anything different. But to think of where they are now versus 5 years, if you project that out another 5 years, 10 years, those things could be really important. And and really help reinforce the sturdiness, durability of these structures, ultimately protect human lives, which is what we're here for.
100%. Yep. Okay. Well, we are getting close on time today. Before we wrap up, and I do think we probably should just have you back for, you know, a second session, because I'd love to hear more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to hear some more about the cool tests that, you know, and what we're learning from those kinds of things. So maybe we'll look at today's session as kind of a 101, the basics of how codes work. Mm-hmm. And then next time we'll dig into some of the funner stuff. So before we do that, though, again, for our listeners today, Bob, if there's one code change you think they should really keep their eyes on over the next couple of years, what would it be?
Well, I think the insurance companies are really focused on getting envelope performance tightened up, pardon the pun, but it's not just wind resistance, it's water resistance to water infiltration during and after a water event, because that's when they're actually seeing a lot of the damage occur. So the building envelope may not only be slightly damaged, right, but the water infiltration is. So it's hard for me to point to a code change proposal, because this is really like 50 or 60 of them probably that'll come through different codes at different places. So I would point the users to, again, their manufacturers and the test requirements, the details, the updates, the documentation, because that doesn't happen in a vacuum. So stay in touch with your manufacturer, stay up to date on that documentation. And as the code changes come into fruition, that's where the rubber's going to meet the road for the installers. And so unless they're just terribly interested and geeked out by these things like I am, don't sit through code change proposals. 90% of it's not going to happen, but it's the 10% that gets through, right, that matters. It might be more like 20% or whatever, but that's what matters, and that's what's going to drive those details and the changes and the certifications that they'll need and the training that their employees will need. So stay in touch, stay engaged in that area, because there are big changes that are going to come.
That's really good advice. Yeah, really good advice. So, you know, I know one of the things at McElroy, we talk a lot about the importance is we consider ourselves partners, right, with our clients and our vendors. And I think that goes exactly to what you're speaking, Bob, especially in regard to code change, too. Make sure you've got that partner that you're leaning on, your manufacturer, getting the latest information, getting training, et cetera, I think is really good advice. So, okay, well, how can our listeners find you, Bob, if they wanted to connect with you?
Well, if it's regarding metal roofing, Metal Construction Association, best way is info@metalconstruction.org. Or if it's me personally, I'm Bob, B-O-B, at ZTECH-consulting.com. And you can also pass on my LinkedIn profile, so you can promote that as well. And, be curious to hear any feedback from today's podcast and presentation. These conversations are fun to have, and I love having them.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise. I know you're a busy guy, and so we really do we consider ourselves grateful and lucky that you joined us today for our listeners. So thanks, Bob.
Right.
Have a great rest
Kathy.
Of your day.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Building with Metal podcast, presented by McElroy Metal. To stay up to date with our latest episodes, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Visit us online at www.mcelroymetal.com for more info and products. Until next time, keep building with metal.